Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart and I'm with lovely Gary Bain. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Pete. How are you?
I'm in peak form, peak form, peak form. I may have
peaked.
I'm
peak a peak Pete, they call you.
Yeah, I might have peaked too early.
You may have peaked on your way here.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what are we doing today, Gary? Tell me.
Well, today we're continuing with our story of the Battle of the Somme. And today, Pete, we're going to cover the tanks.
Tanky
things. And their role in the Battle of Fleurs-Courcelette.
Ooh,
15th of September 1916.
So what are the origins of it? So, because like all battles, it doesn't start on the 15th, does it?
No, I mean, the origins lay way back into the middle of August when Haig sends a memo ordering Rawlinson to prepare plans for an all-out offensive with the aim of capturing the original German third line. Haig considered that the second half of September 1916 would mark the decisive phase of the wearing out
battle.
That the 4th and 5th armies had been waging on the Somme.
Oh, sorry, yeah, that's me. It's probably called the reserve. Is it still called the reserve? When does it change from being a reserve army? I'm not quite sure. That's interesting, that. But yeah, so they're getting all the British reserves and they're going to strike hard to try and... Well, the Germans, Haig thinks the Germans are tottering, doesn't he? After all the battering they've had. And with, of course, where else are the Germans fighting? They're not just fighting the British, are they?
No. And
who else are they fighting?
The Germans?
Yeah.
Oh, they were fighting just about anybody who'd have a fight, Pete.
In the French, you mean? That's them, by definition.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, actually.
So there's Verdun going on, but there's also, of course, and we will come to it later, the French have a Battle of the Somme that's almost as big, if not as big.
Yeah, and we've covered part of that in earlier podcasts. Yeah. But so there was very good reason to consider that the Germans were, as he described them, tottering. It's not that he was wrong, but perhaps they weren't in quite the state that he thought they were.
Now, in our last podcast on the Somme, we were dealing with what Summer Madness, we called it. And this is the piecemeal attempts to get a good start line for this offensive. What are they trying to do? They're trying to get rid of any German strong points which could enfilade the approach of the British in the big attack. Had they succeeded? Had they got all the threatening strong points or is there some left?
No, I mean, the long drawn out struggle still left some key strong points in the German grasp, most evidently in the splintered remnants of High Wood.
Yeah, we talked about Delville Wood, but of course, we pointed out last time, there's lots of fighting going on, and High Wood is a terrible place, isn't it? Terrible.
And also, by the time the British were ready for the next stage, the Germans had, of course, significantly strengthened their defensive positions.
Ooh, the first shall be last, eh? And last shall be first.
Well, that's literally true, because now, as the German third line, such as it was on the 1st of July, was now the German first line. And it was a full-scale trench system grafted out of the rolling chalk downs.
Was it as good as those original? And there were two more systems and lines behind it. But were these new trench lines, were they as good as the original lines that the Germans, after all, had spent years preparing?
Well, they didn't have the deep sunk dugouts of the original defences, but they're still a formidable obstacle to any further progress.
Any hopes for that? I mean, that sounds grim. I mean, what new hope might there be?
Well, there was new hope on the horizon. There was a new weapon of war, Pete.
What's that?
The tank. Now, that offered a slim new hope of shattering the deadlock on the Somme.
Very slim, yeah. So, well, we're not going into the history of the tank. Read anything by Bryn Hammond or others about that. But by 1916, it had been a prolonged gestation stretching through 15 into 16. New weapons always take a while, don't they? And there were two variants. It's a sort of lozenge shape, isn't it? Although I have to think what a lozenge is.
You take it for sore throat, Pete.
All right. So it's sore throat tablet, though. So there's the Mark 1. That's an imaginative name, Mark 1 tank. Two variants. What variants do you think there were?
Well, there was a male variant. And there was a female variant.
What's the difference?
Well, the male tank is armed with 2 6-pounder guns with 3 machine guns for good measure, whilst the female tank had 5 machine guns.
Right. Now, the idea of the tank with the tracks is that they're able to go across difficult ground conditions, get through barbed wire, that is absolutely crucial, whether they're intact or not, and get across trenches. That's why the tracks would help them across that. But I think I'm known to be a tank skeptic. You can over exaggerate their abilities. So what problems does the Mark 1 tank have, British tank have?
Well, for one thing, they could only manage a speed of around about 3 to 4 miles per hour at best.
You're a born bloody optimist, Gary.
Yeah, 3 to 4 miles an hour on completely flat, I think.
Yeah, spell 1 to 2, I think.
Being given a push, yeah. No, they were incredibly slow, is the point.
That is a good point. Walking speed, you'd describe it, I would describe it as, and slow walking speed, more like your walking speed and Fred's walking speed than my walking speed. Yeah.
Thanks, mate. Now, their armour...
Oh, well, that would keep anything out, wouldn't it?
Well, it was no defence against any shellfire at all.
Right.
Small arms weapons could cause what was described as splashes of white-hot metal to bang out inside the tank to a quite painful effect.
Yeah, that's why they developed those masks, isn't it? I think you mentioned that off tape. Sorry, we do chat to each other off tape.
I never talk to you off tape, if I can help it.
These tracks, could they get across anything?
No, I mean, wide trenches, deep craters.
So they could only go across a certain gap of otherwise they'd fall in.
Yeah, well, it's not only that, you know, the mud and tree stumps, that all
tree
brought
stumps,
them.
Tree stumps?
Yeah,
oh,
it all
I can
brought
see
them
that.
Sooner or later to a halt.
A tree stump would sort of, yeah. To sort of get stuck on it, yeah. But were they big, strong machines? They wouldn't break down, though, would they? They'd be super reliable.
Well, no, think about the time and the fact that everything was new. Mechanically, they were unreliable to the extreme, Pete.
What was the environment like in the tank? They had a crew normally of about 8. What was it like for them in the tank?
Well, you would describe it as a dreadful working environment. Visibility.
A bit like the Imperial War was in.
Well, a bit like here. Visibility was extremely difficult.
And you are having a lot of trouble seeing, aren't you? You're actually wearing special glasses because you've just had yet another eye operation for your dodgy vision.
Yeah, now visibility was extremely difficult.
What do you think caused your poor eye? Caused your poor eyesight? Was it something you used to do in your youth?
Yeah, lots of reading.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm going to finish this line if it kills me. Visibility was extremely difficult through narrow slits. Now, that made it difficult to avoid dangerous obstacles or to seek out the enemies because you couldn't see.
It's both ways. You not only can't see that tree trunk or can't see the big, deep trench, but you can't see what the Germans are up to.
No, and you don't know, you know, where to head.
Can you see your friends?
You can't see anything, Pete.
Right, okay.
Now, although the tanks looked big...
They are big. We've seen them.
The engine filled most of the available space, and it made its presence felt in no uncertain terms, a bit like Fred.
Yeah.
The noise was literally deafening.
And were there the same sort of noxious fumes that we'd expect from Fred?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't only the fumes. The heat was enervating.
Enervating?
That means it draining of energy, Pete.
Did you know that?
Because I looked it up. The heat was enervating and noxious fumes, that is like Fred, quickly poisoned the atmosphere.
So how long could the crew manage? I mean, could they stay in there? I mean, what are we talking about?
No, you're talking a few hours at most and then they're literally good for nothing.
Now, who was I have troubles with the tank corps. It's not the tank corps, but this time it's a heavy branch motor machine gun company or something. But who would you imagine, in my view, is the most effective? You know me. You know what I think. Who was the most effective champion of the tank in the early days in 1916?
Well, you've said it on other occasions in the podcast. You think that Haig was probably the most effective champion.
I do.
Why?
Why do I think that?
He not only quickly appreciated its potential, but unlike so many of the, as you described them, vainglorious buffoons.
That's more polite than I usually am. There is a thing of tank corps senior officers. They're an arrogant bunch, and everybody else in the army is a moron, and only they saw the potential of the tank. But that's not true, is it? Because who orders? Who has the power to do things? Who do they think?
It's Haig. Haig gets things done.
Who ordered them in the first place?
A certain Mr. Haig.
And you're going to be General Sir Douglas Haig. General Headquarters.
Yeah, when I said a certain Mr. Haig, what I meant was a certain Sir Douglas Haig. Yes.
Well, I think Haig was the sort of chap who wouldn't mind your informality as a corporal.
No, he'd have loved it. Anyway, General Sir Douglas Haig.
Would that matter, George?
I was present at a demonstration in the use of tanks. A battalion of infantry and five tanks operated together. Three lines of trenches were assorted. The tanks crossed the several lines with the greatest ease, and one entered a wood, which represented a strong point, and easily walked over fair-sized trees of 6 inches through. Altogether, the demonstration was quite encouraging, but we require to clear our ideas as to the tactical handling of these machines.
And that's Haig all over. Haig is impressed, but thinking about how to use them. Who's he thinking of how to use them with?
Well,
it's the infantry and the cavalry. Infantry and artillery, isn't it?
Absolutely. And he's got those three lines to overcome. You know, he's thinking about the whole picture. He's not just thinking about that front line. It's beyond that.
Now, who's responsible for the planning in reality?
Well, Rawlinson and
one of your favourites.
I do quite like Mr. Rawlinson.
What's up with you?
Do you
mean General Sir Henry Rawlinson?
I do quite like General Sir Henry Rawlinson. But on this occasion, he reverted to his usual caution.
Now, we're never quite sure whether he's right to be cautious or not, are we? But the proposals he puts for initial proposals he puts for the 15th of September, they're a carefully staged approach, aren't they? What does he want to do? How does he envisage the attack?
Well, unsurprisingly, he's minded to attack at night,
like the 14th of well, I wish he'd done a bit more of that in August, but never mind. Like the 14th of August.
Yeah, 14th of
August. Oh, July.
July.
Oh dear.
I hate to correct you, Pete.
Well, I like being corrected because I'm an idiot.
Like on the 14th of July, he then intended to pause for a day or so, move up the artillery, and only then to attack again.
Now, why? Why did he think? Why? Why?
Well, he rightly considered that the gap between the new 1st, 2nd and 3rd German lines was cumulatively too wide to allow his field artillery to bombard the rear lines without moving
this
forward.
This is a question of range. We've discussed it before. The range of the field guns, the 18-pounders and the 4.5-inch howitzers is about 6,500 yards at most, which means you can't get too far beyond the British front line before you start the
Yeah, if you're 2,000 yards behind the line,
then there's you've
got an effective 4,000-yard range.
At maximum, yeah. So there. Now, how does Haig react? Well, he's underwhelmed by these plans. So God, you be Haig again. Explain you're going to say what you think.
I studied Rawlinson's proposals for the September attack and for the use of the tanks. In my opinion, he is not making enough of the situation and the deterioration of the enemy's troops. I think we should make our attack as strong and as violent as possible and go as far as possible.
Not bite and hold. Why do you think... Now, Rawlinson is in command of his army, Fourth Army. Why do you think he... Well, Haig's his superior. Haig's still holding loose over him. Neuve-Chapelle, where he'd done something. He'd tried to trash a subordinate. But there's something else. Why else would Rawlinson be in a spot of bother with Haig?
Well, any credit that he'd earned for his bold plan of the 14th of July had long since evaporated.
Notice you keep remembering that date correctly.
Yeah. 6 weeks devoid of any significant success.
So his credit had evaporated away. Any credit he'd earned, he had stuck to his plan against Haig's opposition over the 14th of July. But since then, nothing, no success.
But having said that, you know, Haig's own proposals were themselves flawed.
In what way would you say?
Well, once again, in trying to take three lines and break through the German lines, Haig's running the risk of diluting the artillery preparation and thereby falling at the first hurdle.
Yeah, and committing all his reserves in as well. This is the one thing. If you commit all your reserves in the first attack, you can't react to whatever happens, good or bad, I suppose. Good or bad. What does Rawlinson do?
Well, he's got little choice. He's got to conform to Haig's requirements. So they would attack on a wide front, with each attacking corps using all three divisions on narrow fronts to maximise the impact of the attack.
So the three in line next to each other.
Yeah, and the main thrust, however, would be centred on Flers.
That's the village of Flers, right. What's at the centre of British plans? Is it the tanks?
No, it's as usual, it is the artillery bombardment.
And you know what? Even at Cambrai, a year and a month later, it's still at the centre. It is always at the centre. Artillery, we've talked about this before, but let's just go through it. What are the debates that are going on about artillery, about how it should be used, about the best form? Because they're legion, aren't they, the debates? There's lots and lots of them. What sort of things are being questioned?
Well, once again, they're discussing should they be long and pounding or short hurricane waves of destruction.
Well, hurricane waves of destruction would be best, but what about the barbed wire? Which can't be dealt with in a hurricane bombardment. That's interesting. What else?
They talk about should the infantry be covered by creeping barrages of high explosive or shrapnel shells?
Well, that's the new British development. The French have been working on it. On the internet, people have been saying they even used it in the Boer War. But it's mainly a French development, I think. The British are increasingly using it on the Somme. It's a great British weapon of war. Line of shrapnels moving forward.
The next one we talked about before. What about the counter battery fire coming from the enemy?
Yeah, so you have to take that.
You've got to take that out, because if you don't, they're going to pinpoint you.
Before you go into the attack.
Absolutely.
So, otherwise, they open fire on your infantry and also cut you off.
And infantry caught in the open, they are going to cut out any supporting reserves that are moving forward, but they're also going to identify where your guns are.
Yeah. So another thing is, back to the creeping barrage, I'm sorry, I'm rambling a bit, but how close should the infantry be to that barrage? What do you say about that? We talked about that with the Australians at Pozieres in the last Somme episode. How close you get to the back of it. What's the disadvantage of being right up the rear of the shell, right up close to the shell line as it moves forward?
Well, there comes a point where the casualties from the friendly fire...
shells dropping short?
Yeah, as it would now be described, that outweighs any advantages that you have.
But gunners say their shells never drop short.
Well, they don't.
They do. Warm barrels, bad gunnery, all sorts of reasons, isn't it? Now, the other things, what about one thing that's being discussed increasingly is how many guns do you have ready to go forward as soon as possible behind the infantry to extend that this business of to get at the second and third lines? All of these, they're all, there's so much, isn't there? Is warfare simple in 1916?
No, it's incredibly complicated.
And this is without the logistics of bringing forward the shells and everything else, feeding the armies. Again, we've got a friend who whose name I can't remember. He's a forgettable chap. But logistics. And then the tactics, everything's complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, when's it? Let's remind us, when's this Battle of Flers-Courcelette going to be launched?
Well, it's going to be launched on the 15th of September. Now, there would be approximately one field gun per 10 yards of front, with a medium or heavy gun every 29 yards of the
front. That's about twice they managed on 1st July. But it's about a quarter of what they managed at Neuve-Chapelle. Much shorter front, but it's interesting. How many days? So are they going for a hurricane?
Nope.
Or they go?
So in the end, they decide on a 3-day preliminary bombardment, and some 828,000 shells were fired.
And every one of those shells has to be brought up to the batteries. I mean, that's what I mean by logistics. That's a lot of shells to move about the battlefield. Now, how are they going to actually use the tanks? I mean, you've got the infantry, you've got the artillery, and of course you've got the cavalry. How are we going to fit into the all arms battle, very early stages? How are we going to fit the tanks in?
Well, after a closely debated discussion, it's decided that the tanks would be employed in small groups of three, scattered along the front line, with the aim of moving ahead of the attacking troops to suppress identified German strong points.
So they're splitting them up. So no, surely I'm not sure about that. But rather than a concentrated punch, they're going for a little bit. Where do the tanks stand in the minds of Haig and Rawlinson?
Well, both Haig and Rawlinson still absolutely wedded to the concept of the primacy of artillery,
but
were seen as a promising addition to the book of war, but they didn't yet deserve any greater status than that of an addendum.
Is the book of war like the book of love?
No. Now, it's therefore particularly ironic in their efforts to accommodate the tanks into their plans that actually they fatally dilute the power of the guns and thereby rendered the infantry appallingly vulnerable if the tanks failed.
Well, I'm going to read. I think we need an excerpt from the... this is from the Instructions to the Employment of Tanks, Headquarters, 4th Army. Tanks will start movement at a time so calculated that they will reach their objectives 5 minutes before the infantry. The infantry will advance as usual behind a creeping barrage in which gaps about 100 yards wide will be left for the route of the tanks, some minutes before their arrival at these objectives. Right, I can see a problem here. Let's see if you can. Is this sensible?
Well, at first glance, it does seem sensible. However, in the attack on the most dangerous German strong points, there'd be no creeping barrage. And if the tanks failed, the infantry would be left to their own devices.
So it would mean that the infantry don't have any artillery cover because the tanks meant to be there, but the tanks haven't made it. If so, let's hope the tanks are completely reliable, eh?
Absolutely. Now, overall, it's clearly emphasised that if the tanks were held up for any reason, the infantry were not to wait, but were to push on regardless. Yet if the tanks succeeded and the infantry were checked, the tanks must turn back and endeavour to assist them.
So the infantry are still the primary force there. On the actual battlefield, on the ground, behind the cover umbrella of the artillery, the infantry are the primary force. They always are. Now, how do you think, would the troops know what was going on? Or how do they react to the tanks?
No, I mean, as they...
Is it a secret weapon?
Yeah, I mean, as the troops move forward, they become aware of an overall sense of secrecy and general mystery that surrounded the new weapon that had been added to the armoury of the British Army for this offensive. And there were wild rumours.
Do you mean the British Army's prone to rumour?
Yeah, soldiers do talk to each other. And these rumours abounded as to what the mysterious shapes cloaked beneath the tarpaulins might be.
What could they be? Strange tank-shaped things. And this is where the whole thing of the code word of tank being
water... Yeah, being water tank. Yeah,
I'm not sure about that. I think I always thought it was true, actually, but I don't know. Now, so what happened on the night of 14th of September? The tanks moved forward. Didn't you say they were noisy?
So the tanks move forward, and the last couple of miles, there's a constant drone of low-flying aircraft. Now, that's intended to cancel out the roar of their infernal engines.
Oh, infernal engines.
The tank crews, they're tired, for they've had little opportunity for rest in the previous 48 hours, and the task of moving the tanks forward was somewhat fraught, I'd say so, at that sort of speed.
Right. Well, the routes were marked out with white tapes for them, they're cumbersome, aren't they? And what do you think? Is the Somme battlefield flat and easy to get across, do you think?
Yes.
No.
We mentioned earlier, visibility. So even if there is a white tape, you've got to be able to see it to follow it.
So how many of the... There were 48 tanks. But Haig, by the way, had been asking for hundreds, but he hadn't got them. That's not his fault. That's manufacturing. They had 48 tanks meant to go over the top. How many actually get to the jumping-off stations? I don't mean over the line. I mean to the jumping-off.
36.
That's not many, is it, Gary? Is that a quarter of them don't make it?
That's a quarter of them don't make it, Pete. Your maths is brilliant.
Well, thank you. So everything's ready for the big attack. It's not a local affair, is it? It's a big offensive. It's not only the three corps of 4th Army, which are, quick spot test.
3rd, the 14th and the 15th.
Yes, I put them in the wrong order to try and fool you.
You did.
but also the Reserve Army, who's the Canadian Corps and the French Army would also be attacking. The Reserve Army Canadian Corps. They're in the Reserve Army. I'm confusing people. And the French Army, who we must not forget. We will be doing a special podcast on that with a lovely special guest. So how many British divisions in all are attacking?
There's 10 British divisions, and the odds are roughly at 2-1 in their favour.
Last chance of winning the war in 1916? I don't think so, but I suppose it could be portrayed as that, couldn't it, if you like. What's it like on 15th of September?
Well, it's a typical sunny day on the Somme. It's early autumn.
Guns go bang.
Guns go bang. The guns roar, Pete, and the infantry waited in their assembly trenches for the whistles to blow.
Now, this is another of our typical over-the-top stories, and waiting in those trenches is Sergeant Harold Horn of the 1st 6th Northumberland Fusiliers, a fine body of men, and you're going to be Harold.
The hour before zero, while crouching in the trench and looking at one's watch, was an almost unbearable strain. Eventually, we heard the hum of machinery coming up behind us and saw through the mist great toad-like things with caterpillar tracks, a gun projecting forward, and at the back a tower with two small wheels came lumbering over the shell hole ground at walking pace. One tank followed the tape to the field in place in the trench where I was and went on towards the German line. A few moments later, it was our zero time and we got out of the trench and followed. Once in the open and going forward, the tension and fear lessened to some extent, and a feeling of excitement took over, helped in this case, I suppose, by curiosity about the tanks.
Now, in this attack, once again, Garrett, we can't do it all, can we? We just don't have time or the inclination to cover. This is a massive attack, 10 divisions. It's huge, and that's not counting the French. It's huge. So we're just going to follow three of the sort of, we said that they were going to go forward in threes, just three of the tank attacks. I think we ought to pay tribute to our Canadian friends and look at the attack of the Canadian Corps and their tanks. They're part of General Gough's Reserve Army, and they're pushing out from Pozières towards the village of Courcelette. An easy thing, do you think?
No, it's a difficult nut to crack, and that's actually on the left of the assaulting British formations. So now, at this point, Pete, I think it's unfortunate to record that there was a vicious practicality about the orders given to the Canadians, and you're going to be Private Lance Catamol of the 21st Eastern Ontario Battalion.
We were given strict instructions to take no prisoners until our objective had been gained. The reason for this was that so often in British advances, when the Germans had thrown down their arms in surrender and our men had moved through them, at the same time indicating to them to go to the rear where they would be collected as prisoners, the Germans had picked up their rifles again and shot our men in the back, thereby bringing the advance to a halt. No such risks could or would be taken in this important advance. That's a set of murderous orders, in my view. So what are they going for?
Well, immediately in front of the 21st Canadian Battalion was the sugar refinery, which was just to the north of the main road passing through from Pozières via Courcelette to Bapaume. The Germans had converted the factory into a fortress with several well-concealed machine guns, and once more, you're going to be Private Lance Catamol.
I never heard our officers' whistles to signal the advance, and I don't suppose they heard them either because of the terrible crash with which the creeping barrage opened up exactly at 6:20 a.m. The air over our heads was suddenly filled with a soughing and sighing, whining and screaming of thousands of shells of all calibres, making it impossible to hear anything. We stood up, and I looked around behind me. As far as the eye could see, from left to right, there was a sheet of flame from the hundreds of guns lined up, almost wheel to wheel, belching fire and smoke. It was an awe-inspiring sight.
Wow. Now, when they go over the top, they entered a veritable inferno of German shell fire raking across the battlefield.
Hang on. That means that the counter-battery fire had not been effective.
No.
So this is part of the planning that isn't working yet. It doesn't work for quite a while after this.
Now, as they approached the refinery, the attack stalled under the weight of German fire and the infantry went to ground. It was at this point that one of the attached tanks made a dramatic appearance.
Now, you're going to be Private Magnus McIntyre Hood, a 24th Victoria Rifles Battalion. He's Canadian, of course. He sees this saviour coming through across the battlefield.
The attack had been held up at this point, and a party of us had to rush up with more ammunition, bullets and grenades to the 21st Battalion, lying in shell holes in front of the refinery. As we reached them, we saw a land ship named the Creme de Menthe pass ahead and go right up to the walls of the refinery, its guns blazing. It seemed to lean against one of the walls, which collapsed, and the monster roared into the fort while we could see the Germans streaming out of it, offering an excellent target to the riflemen in the shell holes.
Now, this Creme de Menthe, that's C5. It's a male tank, i.e. it's got six-pounders as well as machine guns. It was commanded by Captain Arthur Inglis of C Company, Heavy Branch Machine Gun Company. This dramatic, it's very dramatic, it's super dramatic appearance of the tanks. I mean, what sort of an effect does it have on the Germans? Well, presumably they've already been battered to buggery by the shells. It must have been quite traumatic. And you're going to tell all, as Feldwebel Weinart of the 211th Infantry Regiment
A man came running in front from the left, shouting, "There is a crocodile crawling into our lines." The poor wretch was off his head. He had seen a tank for the first time and had imagined this giant of a machine, rearing up and dipping down as it came to be a monster. It presented a fantastic picture, this colossus in the dawn light. One moment, its front section would disappear into a crater, with the rear section still protruding. The next, its yawning mouth would rear up out of the crater to roll slowly forward with terrifying assurance.
Now, thanks to this tank, and it probably is thanks to this tank, that was a wonderful reading, by the way. The sugar refinery is captured. The Canadian infantry sweep through, don't they? So it's all well?
They've done well, but there was a brutality about their approach, which the men felt was officially sanctioned. And you're going to be Private Lance Catamol.
We came upon an enemy trench to our left. In keeping with our no prisoners order, this trench was being mopped up and the occupants eliminated. The trench was already half full of dead enemy, and here and there little columns of steam rose above the cool morning air, either from hot blood or from urine, which I understand is released on the death of any human body. Two Canadians stood over the trench, one on the parapet and the other on the parados, and they exterminated the Germans as they came out of their dugouts. One young German, scruffy, bareheaded, cropped hair and wearing steel-rimmed spectacles, ran, screaming with fear, dodging in and out amongst us to avoid being shot, crying out, "Nine! Nine!" He pulled out from his breast pocket a handful of photographs and tried to show them to us. I suppose they were of his wife and children, in an effort to gain our sympathy. It was all of no avail. As the bullet smacked into him, he fell to the ground motionless, the pathetic little photographs fluttering to the earth around him. I find this very difficult.
That is incredibly. I mean, we've done a lot of podcasts now, but that one quote, I think, is one of the worst that I've read.
Well, the pathetic little photographs fluttering to the ground.
That's awful.
It strikes a chord. I think there are reasons that these Canadian units behaving like this. Are those reasons a sufficient excuse for what seems to be cold-blooded murder?
There's no excuse for what, on the face of it, is appalling conduct. There's simply no necessity for the murder of, in particular, that soldier.
Right. So we'll leave that there. We're not getting at the Canadians here. This is the sort of conduct that various units. It's one of those things that happen at war. War is not nice. Now, to their right, further to the south, the 15th Corps, and that's who's that? Quick!
It's without under thinking, the command of Lieutenant General Henry Horne.
Ooh, it's in New Zealand, the 41st and the 14th Divisions, and they're the ones that are driving well, the tanks are towards flares. Who's helping them get flares? This is the key point as far as we're concerned.
Well, they had some 18 tanks of D Company, Heavy Machine Gun Company, to help them with the daunting task, although only 14 of them managed to drag themselves even as far as the starting point.
And a lot of them don't get much further than that. Now, we're looking at one tank. It's a very famous tank. It's a D-17 commanded by 2nd Lieutenant Stuart Hasty. He called it Dinnerken, but we won't be doing accents, right? His second gearsman in his tank, he's the commander of D-17, is Gunner Roy Reifer, and you're going to read a quote from him, Gary.
"We were a mail tank and carried 2 6-pounder guns with several hundred rounds of ammunition and some Hotchkiss light machine guns with .303 ammunition. Our tank was filled up with stores of all kinds, drums of engine oil, gear oil, iron rations, gas masks, equipment, overalls, revolvers, anti-bump your head against the roof of the tank, leather helmets, carrier pigeons in a basket, semaphore signals. We even went into action with 10 2-gallon tins of petrol, flaming red in colour, on the outside of the tank on either side of the exhaust pipes."
Hang on a minute. That sounds dangerous to me.
It sounds dangerous to me as well. Now, I'm just thinking about the poor pigeons.
Yum, yum.
Now, unfortunately, a somewhat farcical incident soon removed two of the tanks trundling towards Flers. Tank D9, commanded by 2nd Lieutenant Victor Huffam, was following Tank D14, commanded by 2nd Lieutenant G.F. Court, when they came to grief in embarrassing fashion. And you're going to be 2nd Lieutenant Victor Huffam of Tank D9.
Now, he's not the brightest tool in the whatever it is, toolbox. In the tank. he really isn't. So he's following Court's tank, 2nd Lieutenant Court's tank. And Huffam says this: "Before we'd gone 200 yards, Court attempted to cross a disused support trench. As he crossed it, the tank weighed 28 tons. The parapet crumbled beneath him. His tail end, the backside of the tank, disappeared into the trench. He scrambled out of his tank, quite a job, and he came back to me. Now, we'd been equipped with a very large iron hooks on the stern of our tanks, and we had wire hawsers coiled on the roof. Court was a particular friend of mine, so I manoeuvred up behind him and attempted to come alongside of him, to cross in front of him and try to tear him out. But in manoeuvring alongside of him, my sponson got tangled with his, and the two tanks were locked together. Why do I think he's a moron?
Well, apart from the fact you think most people are.
That's not true, Gary.
Because he's put his tank at risk, frankly.
And who are these tanks really meant to be responsible
They're to? They're meant to be supporting the infantry in the taking of Fleurs.
So does it matter that Court's a particular friend of him?
No.
He's got a completely wrong set of priorities here, hasn't he?
He has, and it's really difficult because it's very painful when your sponsons get tangled.
Oh, that is terrible. Yeah.
Now, there's nothing more they can do but climb onto the roof and watch the rest of the battle. Now, that's quite telling in itself.
I wonder what the infantry thought of this.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have complained, that is one thing.
Well, they wouldn't have complained, but they would have thought it was wretched bad luck. They might have thought it was even ineptitude.
Yes, inept, yes, definitely. Now, passing close to them, D-17, that's Second Lieutenant Stuart Hastie, he continues up the main road. They're going directly into Flowers. You can actually follow this in a map. And there's great books about this. I've forgotten the chap who wrote it now. Good God, he's dead now. He was brilliant. There's a brilliant book on the tank attack at Flowers. And you're going to be Second Lieutenant Stuart Hastie, who speaks in an Edinburgh accent.
It was up to me to carry on alone. Having crossed the front German line, I could see the old road down into Flowers, which was in a shocking condition, having been shelled by both sides. At the other end of this road, about a mile away, which was about the limit of my vision from the tank, I could see the village of Fleurs, more or less clouded with smoke from the barrage which had come down on top of it, and the houses. Some of them painted white, some seemed to be all kinds of colours. Across the front of the village we could see the wire of a trench named Fleurs Trench, and this formed a barricade in front of the village on the British side.
Now, you can see all this on the maps, and we will put up a map of Fleurs.
We made our way down the remnants of this road with great difficulty. Just as we started off, our steering gear was hit, and we resorted to steering by putting on the brake on each track alternatively.
Now, the steering gear, is that the two wheels?
That's the two wheels externally at the back of the tank, yeah.
And instead, he's using the brakes on the things, slowing one track.
Slowing one track.
Which makes you go...
Yeah, either left or right. It depends which one you slow. And we resorted to steering by putting on the brake on each track alternatively and trying to keep the tank following the line of the Fleurs-Delville Wood Road. When we got down to Fleurs Trench and passing into the village, there was a great deal of activity from the eaves under the roofs of the cottages and also from a trench which appeared to be further through the village but which we couldn't just locate at that point.
Poor visibility. So when he says activity, he means people shooting at them. So yeah. There's bits of splash flying around the tank, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Loads of... It must have been horrible in there. Now, above them, there's a contact patrol of the Royal Flying Corps. And it sights the D-17 moving through the flares. And there's a message which is famous. Tank seen in Main Street. Flares going on with large numbers of troops following it. There weren't exactly large numbers of troops following it because it was pretty well on its own. And the press make that. The press reported that tank. Did you think the press ever exaggerate things or in any way change things?
No.
What do the press report that?
The press report it entirely accurately as a tank is walking up the high street of Fleurs with the British Army cheering behind.
Yeah, bollocks. The D-17 soon in trouble. Actually, this is part of the myth of the tanks on the Somme. What is Stuart Hastie achieving with his D-17?
Well, he's not achieving very much. He's literally crashing around the ruins of Fleurs without solid infantry support. Now, that's, you know,
some
not
of
to
them
say
had
some
got,
hadn't got through. They had
some had got into the village behind him, and that's what the aircraft saw. But what have they done when the German opened battery fire? Opened
well, they're naturally taking cover. They've gone to ground. It's an entirely sensible thing to do, and they were invisible from the D-17.
Couldn't see what's happening. So you're going to be Stuart Hastie again, Second Lieutenant Stuart Hastie, D-17.
Having steered the engine by using the brakes up to this point, The engine was beginning to knock very badly, and it looked as if we wouldn't be fit to carry on very much further. We made our way up the main street, during which time my gunners had several shots at various people who were underneath the eaves or even in the windows of some of the cottages. We went on down through the high street as far as the first right angle bend. We turned there, and the main road goes for a matter of 200 to 300 yards, and then turns another right angle to the left and proceeds out through towards Guadalcanal. But we did not go past that point. At this point, we had to make our minds up what to do. The engine was really in such a shocking condition that it was liable to let us down at any moment. So I had a look around, so far as it was possible, to do in that middle of a village being shelled at that time by both sides. I could see no signs of the British Army coming up behind me. So I slewed the tank round with great difficulty on the brakes and came back to Fleur's Trench and turned the tank again to face the Germans.
Now, we know that later on this is how they steer it. But, of course, he's never practised it, has he? He doesn't know how to do it. That's how you steer a tank later on. But that's interesting. Then what happens? What happens? Well, one of the tracks is hit. Can tanks go with one track?
No, I mean, at that point, it's immobilised.
And, I think there's a picture of it in Fleur's Trench.
Yeah,
it?
They abandon it in the trench.
Have they achieved much?
No, apart from a lot of excitement.
Yeah. Now, next to them, on the right of 4th Army, between them and the French, essentially, is the 14th Corps. Who are they?
It's the Guards 6th and 56th Divisions.
And they're attacking on a front stretching from Ginchy, we talked about Ginchy in the Summer Madness episode, to Combles. Again, they're allotted 15 tanks, 9 for the Guards Division and 3 each for the 6th and 56th Divisions. I'm sorry to say, this is not a great hour for the Tank Corps, what would become the Tank Corps. The tanks do not do well here as the assault tactics break down. The Royal Artillery had carefully left these 100-yard gaps, then the tanks don't appear. Loads of the tanks in this area don't appear. So what happens to the infantry in front of those gaps?
Well, the results are predictably disastrous. Without a creeping barrage, the infantry were exposed to deadly fire from all sides.
And another thing, the preliminary bombardment seems to have been badly directed in this area. A lot of the trenches, the German trenches, seem to be still intact. Why aren't they there? Well, of the three, let's look at in front of 6th Division. Let's look at that, in front of 6th Division, yeah? In front of 6th Division, they're facing the German side of our Hoth redoubt. We call it the quadrilateral because we've got no imagination. Also, the Germans have no imagination. They call theirs Sidau Hoth, and we call it the quadrilateral. Brilliant. So what went wrong?
It all starts to go wrong the night before, actually. As they're moving forwards...
They've got three tanks.
Of the three tanks allotted, two break down while moving forward, and they've got to be left behind. It's only left one tank to carry forward the hopes of the 6th Division the next morning.
Who's that then?
The C-22, which was commanded by 2nd Lieutenant Basil Henriquez.
Nice, normal. Yeah. There's lots of controversy about this tank. It's been claimed that Henriquez opens fire on some of the 9th Norfolks while behind the British line. I don't know whether this is true or not. The 9th Norfolks thought it was true, and he's the only one moving in that sector. Why do you think that... this is the visibility question again, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's also supposed to have moved forward too early and thus aroused the German suspicions, with the result that they dropped a brief but damaging artillery barrage on the British troops.
He's meant to come out just a bit before. Sorry, but he comes out too early.
Yeah. So they're actually under an artillery barrage whilst they're still waiting for 0 hour.
So it's certainly not 0 hour when C-22 starts to move across No Man's Land, heading to the quadrilateral, the Sidau Hoth redoubt. The Germans, how do they react in turn? I mean, does everything go perfectly for them?
Well, they seem to have been stupefied by its strange appearance, and they fail to open fire as the C-22 slowly rumbled across to their lines.
So when they get to the front, German front line, what happens then? Well, he opens fire, doesn't he, Enriquez? His gunners open up.
His gunners open up, and this brings the Germans to their senses, and they opened a heavy small arms fire on the tank. Which...
Now, here's an interesting point, because it's not when it is small arms, but there's something special about the ammunition used against this tank. What is it? Well, and it's a sign of the future, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It included armour-piercing rifle ammunition.
Why would they have that? Why?
It's normally used to penetrate the metal shields that were used by British snipers.
Oh, the sniper plates?
Yeah. Now, you're going to be...
I'm going to be Basil Enriquez.
Second Lieutenant Basil Enriquez of the C-22 tank.
I'm not sure he'll get much promotion after this. All the time I had the front flaps open, for visibility was far too restricted if they were shut. But after a hail of machine gun fire, I closed them tightly for the first time. Then the periscope got hit away. Then the small prisms got broken, one after another. Then armour-piercing bullets began to penetrate, in spite of the fact that the tanks were said to be completely proof against them. Then my driver got hit. Then one of my gunners. Then I got splinters in the face and legs. Meanwhile, the gunners claimed to have killed or hit 20 or 30 of the enemy. I could see absolutely nothing. The only thing to do was to open the front flap slightly and peep through. Eventually, this got hit, so it was hanging only by a thread, and the enemy could fire in at us at close range. It's going badly, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just at this point the British barrage burst out at 06:30.
So that'd be the creeping barrage for the infantry.
Yeah, now, fortunately, for the C-22 at least... The barrage was not directed at the quadrilateral, as it was located within one of the tank lanes, which was left in the barrage.
Of course. So it's all right.
So as the men of the 6th Division moved forward across no man's land, they're being met with a howl of fire. And you're going to be 2nd Lieutenant Basil Enriquez again.
Yeah, because there's only just... Yeah, this is just one tank. So it's had an impact where it's gone through the lines, but are very localised. And for the rest of it, the infantry are, well, in that 100 yards. He says this, as the infantry were now approaching, and it was impossible to guide the car, by car he means tanky thing, and as I now discovered the sides weren't bulletproof, I decided that to save the tank from being captured, I had better withdraw. How we got back, I shall never understand. We dodged shells from the artillery. It was just a preserving hand, it means God, I think, which saved us. It was like hell in a rough sea made of shell holes. The way we got over the ground was marvellous. Every moment we were going to stick, but we didn't. The sight of thousands of men dying and wounded was ghastly. I hate to think of it all. Why might he hate to think of the men lying on the battlefield?
Well, for two reasons I can think of. A, he's actually leaving the battlefield.
Yes.
So he's exposing them to more fire. And B, we said he can't see.
So he might have run over.
He might have run over some of them.
I think that would be in his mind. I think there's a lot of inconsistencies in Basil Enriquez's story. I'm not sure about this retiring just as the infantry are there.
On the other hand,
what are we to throw brickbats at an officer who's trying his best and clearly suffering from stress? And
there are inconsistencies, though, Pete. He seemingly can see well enough to steer from the battlefield just as the infantry need him the most. And yet he left the battlefield because he couldn't see and he couldn't navigate the field.
The attack was a success, was it?
No, it hardly needs to be said. It's a dreadful failure.
Now, what is the reason for the failure? Is it that all the fault of the tanks then?
No, I mean, as we mentioned earlier, they are, after all, only an adjunct to the artillery and infantry that together still ruled the battlefield.
So it's not just their fault. What is it? What is it that is it then?
Well, you've got to go back to the planning and look at the deliberate weakening of the artillery to allow for the tanks.
But that's not the tanks' fault.
And then the inability to respond swiftly by filling the gaps when it became apparent that the tanks were letting them down.
Well, I can understand that if you look at it from an artillery point of view, because artillery cannot just react like this. They have to fire, plan fire. You can't just launch a creeping barrage from nothing. You have to plan it. It's all drawn up beforehand. That's interesting. That is interesting. And I'm going to be 2nd Lieutenant Basil Enriquez again. And he's sort of looking at the situation. He says this: if only we had been able to reconnoitre her. If only we had some kind of training with the infantry. If only there had been some semblance of cooperation with the artillery. If only there had been proper practice over ground that was like the Somme. And if only we had a little more sleep and a little less showing off. What a marvellous story this Somme battle might have been. Yeah, all right, mate. Some of them had trained. The question of tank infantry cooperation is as almost as long as the history of warfare. It is difficult, and they're still pondering on it in the Second World War. It's difficult because tanks are difficult to communicate with.
If you compare it to the nadir of the August and early September operations, the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelettes actually a startling success.
Yeah, well, because it's a big, wide front battle, isn't it? So why is it a success?
A considerable stretch of the German front line's been captured.
Yep, that's right, all around Flers, up around Corselet.
And their second line had been significantly breached in the Flers sector.
Yeah, because they got through and towards Guédicourt. Yeah, that's right.
Now, the long overdue capture of High Wood.
Well, we've not talked about this, but this is what I mean. This is all going on as well, isn't it?
And the final portions of Bazentin Ridge can be seen as a success of sorts. High Wood opened
up. Why is High Wood important?
Well, it opened up a far better tactical situation for the British with a much enhanced observation over the German lines.
You get a good view from there.
You get a good view from there.
Now, what do the Germans do? How do the Germans react to this battle?
Well, they a few days later, they bow at the inevitable, and they retreat back onto the low Le Transloy Ridge.
Yeah, it's not much of a ridge, but it is. They just drop back, don't they? Now, let's analyse the performance of the tanks. I know that I have a perception of the use of tanks on the 15th September, and can you guess the word that comes to my mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be difficult to describe it without using the word failure.
Yeah. Yet, nevertheless...
There are some positives. Although Haig had ordered a large number of tanks, as soon as he was aware of their potential, there'd been a manifest disappointment in the inability of the hard-pressed British munitions industry to deliver them on time.
So they've got a lot of things on their
plate. Tanks,
aeroplanes,
shells. You had a shell shortage in 1915.
So there's a problem. So that's not the tank's fault.
No.
Not the tank's fault. There should have been a lot more of them. Now, were the officers and crews, as Enriquez says, not properly trained?
Well, they hadn't had the time to be properly trained. The infantry units that surrounded them in action had no chance to train with them at all. This is the secrecy issue.
Yeah, and Enrique is right there. We don't like Enrique much, but...
we don't dislike him.
Yeah, don't dislike him, but the poor chap's doing his best, isn't he? But they've not had proper chance to train with them. The tanks themselves, what about the
Well,
tanks?
This is really telling. I mean, this is an issue, I think. The tanks that went into action are plagued with mechanical failures, and their speed was too slow to even keep up with the infantry when things were going well. Too slow to rush to the point of need when things were going badly.
So they're just too bloody slow.
I mean, that's really telling. The infantry moved faster than the tank.
Why mechanical failures? Because any new machinery is going to break down. Till you've got fitters and people who've mastered it, it's going to break down, isn't it? It's just the way it is. What about the visibility issue? That really is the environment inside the tank. What does that do to the fighting efficiency of the crews?
Well, it's completely compromised, and you know they can't last very much more than a couple of hours in that environment, and it's completely debilitating. The visibility question is a real issue. If you cannot see either the enemy or your path, you are actually moving forward blindly.
Now, so overall, in the battle, when things went well, the tanks were a useful adjunct. They helped the things. But where they failed, the artillery were unable to respond, were they? They just couldn't. Artillery can't quickly respond to sudden changes in plan. And the infantry were left on their own. What do you think sensible officers thought after the battle?
Well, sensible officers, they avoided all the hyperbole and they actually saw the tanks for what they really were. Haig himself would see the potential of the tank, and he ordered thousands more.
I'd say he was a true father of the tank corps myself. Not you know, I like saying that because it really annoys tankies.
Yeah.
But if anyone was a father of the tank corps, it was Haig.
But some people have claimed that he should have withheld its use of, you know, this new super weapon until there were sufficient numbers to end the war in a single mighty stroke.
These people are complete and utter idiots. And I can actually become quite cross with these people. Let's just look at this. This is not how weapon development is achieved, is it? There's two things. Is the 1916 Mark I a fully developed article of weapon of war?
No, and there were further marks which tells you that.
Yeah, well, Mark IV is, I think, the next, the one, yeah.
As we've said, they were mechanically unreliable and...
Too few of them.
Too slow and cumbersome, and they had limited powers of both offence and defence.
What do you have to do to a weapon of war before you can use it effectively?
Well, until weapons have been used in active service conditions, it's almost impossible to judge their efficacy in action. To carry out the development work to eradicate technical problems, for example, the external steering, the wheels at the back, they were unnecessary and they were in fact removed.
Also, you have to work out your tactics. Are you going to leave lanes free? No, you're not. Lanes for them to go without artillery barrels. You can't do this sort of thing. You have to sort these things out. What also do you have to do about the crews?
Well, you've got to train the crews under the pressure of battle. And
again, Enriquez does refer to it, doesn't he?
Yeah, and generally, you've got to develop the tank as offensive weapons of war within the total effort.
You mean the all-arms battle, as would be in 1918?
Absolutely, and after all, the Battle of the Somme, it's no skirmish.
Oh,
is it?
Hang on, I see what you're saying, and that you've got you can't just stop. You can't say, oh well, we won't fight till 1917, November 1917, the Battle of Cambrai. Well, we'll unleash it as a huge surprise. You can't wait a year. Why not?
Well, because the Somme's the major offensive. Allied offensive of 1916, and Britain was...
Can't we just tell the French?
No, Britain was very much the junior partner in the coalition with France.
So it's a kitchen sink battle, is it? What do I mean by kitchen sink
battle?
Well,
everything that was thrown in that might add weight to the battering ram of British arms and thereby finally overthrow the brick wall of German resistance in September 1916.
So everything's thrown in. It's all thrown in. That's it, isn't it? And that's why Haig deployed the tanks, because... He hoped it would work.
And there were levels of success that meant that, ultimately, it was developed further, more were ordered, and ultimately it was used in the all-arms battles of 1918.
And they don't use the steering wheels because they discovered they could do without them. And that's the sort of weapon development. And a whole series of SS pamphlets, how to use tanks in the offensive, how to do this, how to use that. That's all part of what's called the learning curve. Not a phrase we like using, but it's all part of the learning process, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, the tanks were... absolutely a brand new weapon of war.
Yeah, and that Battle of Flers Courcelette, the tank corps will always remember it, and we've enjoyed talking about it, haven't we?
Cheers,
sad
Pete.
At times. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?